Let's make it happen, Captain!
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
I'm Gov Maharaj.
Welcome to Defrag. And what was the conversation we had today about webcams and laptops? We've been talking about everything.
We're talking about everything, yeah.
We're ready to go. All right, well, let's take first question. From Edward, I can't get Explorer to run. I double-click on my computer or use Windows E, etc., and it never appears. After discussing with Andrew, we came up to the assumption that it's caused by the following. Is there a workaround? I use the version control tool, Tortoise SVN and Tortoise Git on my machine all the time. They put icons over Explorer icons to indicate the version control status, and since changing from Mesh to SkyDrive now also has icons from SkyDrive folder. Note that I have no overlap of folders. I updated Tortoise Git, etc., and it seems a little better, but not perfect. Help appreciated.
So the overlays that they're talking about, I don't know. Let's see if I can show any. Yeah, I mean, that's a system drive overlay. Let's see. Occasionally, you'll notice ones with a lock, and I don't think I have any showing, but here's a shortcut overlay.
Yeah,
you know,
I think anyone who's a developer would know this from just using
sure.
know, the tools they use to check in code.
Right. So an overlay is, you know, just a hint that is done by like a shell extension.
Yeah.
That can show, you know, what type of folder this is. If you have a lock, it shows that you have different permissions and what's that on the parent. If you notice, like, sometimes a folder might be colored green, that's if it's encrypted, or if it's blue, if it's compressed.
Yeah.
You know, that's not an icon overlay, but it's a feature of the shell to, you know, differentiate visually some differences. Now, the overlays themselves, in this case, are unlikely to be the thing that's actually causing Explorer from not opening.
Yeah.
But it is more than likely to be the namespace extension or another shell extension that's loaded in the process that is causing this.
Yeah.
So, you know, a couple of things to try here is uninstall SkyDrive, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
See if that helps. Because if you've got two different syncing type engines, and that's what Tortoise SVN is. It's a version control, it's syncing. They may be competing with each other. Their namespace extensions may be competing with each other. So I would try uninstalling, disabling, whatever it is that you can do to at least one of them to get back to a known state where Explorer is running again. If you can't do that, you know, take a dump of the process, launch Task Manager, Control Shift Escape, so you don't need Explorer actually running.
Yeah.
At the time, so you don't have to ensure that you got the taskbar or anything like that if it's not working correctly. And just go to details and go to explore, right click, create dump file. Do that, send me the dump. I can at least take a look at what's going on in the process. Maybe there's something else, another shell extension that mm-hmm. you don't even know about that's actually causing the issue.
Okay.
I can say, however, that I've tried at least with a basic setup of SkyDrive and Tortoise SVN, and I was not able to repair this problem.
Hmm. Okay. All right, and I think it's Andrew Richards' brother who sent that question. So he has his own tech support system within his family.
Right.
Yeah. All right, from Mark. 70% of the time, the network access icon in the SysTray shows a normal internet connection. All network activity works fine. The remaining time, the icon will show limited access. Oddly, all network connectivity, including access to websites via IE or Firefox, works fine. The Windows Store apps that require internet connectivity do not work. Showing a message says internet connectivity is not available. I'd ignore the limited access notification, except I really like the apps with live tiles like CNN and music apps like Slacker. They don't work when limited access notification is showing.
Right. So a couple of things. The limited access notification, what that is the system is basically pinging the internet, a particular website, it's a Microsoft website, I believe, to see if it's available.
Yeah.
That will determine whether or not you only have, you know, access to your local network. So it already knows that you have a real IP address, for
mm-hmm.
one.
Yeah.
So you're not on a 169 address,
mm-hmm.
Which is one of the virtual fake IPs. So it can tell that you've got a real IP, but you're having problems contacting a well-known site on the internet.
Yeah.
So that's why it shows limited access.
So my first instinct was maybe it's a hardware problem, but you were saying no way.
It's unfortunately not a hardware problem, because if it was hardware, you know, a loose link or something, it would show no connectivity.
Yeah.
And the regular internet, i.e. in Firefox and Chrome and whatever, those sites are obviously working.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason that the modern apps, the Windows Store apps, don't work is because the limited access is an initial check.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the other web browsers, they don't care about the limited access.
Yeah.
Right? But the Windows Store apps do care about the limited access check. They first check to see, hey, do I have internet connectivity? And then it'll give you that wonderfully semi-helpful dialogue that says, you know, you don't appear to be connected to the internet. What you can do are a couple of different things. If you're on Wi-Fi, you can check your power options. And I know this is kind of odd, but check your power options to see if the wireless is going into a power safe state, so it's not quite as strong a signal.
Yeah.
So that's under wireless adapter settings, power saving mode. You change it to maximum performance for both.
Mm-hmm.
That is one option. The other option that you can do is a couple of different things. If you're seeing this on a few different machines within your network, or if it's only on the one machine, most routers, if you're connected to a router, can change the default DNS server that it uses to contact.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of good ones out there. If you're on Comcast, they have a particular one. Go check out Comcast site. I'm with Comcast, so it's my frame of reference.
So do you use a Comcast DNS?
I use OpenDNS.
Yeah.
So
would using the Comcast DNS make your internet faster because you're connecting to the cable modem's head end instead of...
It won't make your internet faster. It will ideally make your name resolution faster.
Yeah, so resolving a URL could be faster if you
could
use...
be faster, yes.
Yeah.
So you can try changing your DNS settings either on the network adapter itself. Can show you how to do that here.
And by faster, I mean by milliseconds, not probably by...
Yeah,
basically,
yes. So go check out your network connections. Go down to IPv4, properties. You can, right now DNS is automatically set. You know, I'm here on the Microsoft network. And you can change it. And there are numerous DNS servers out there.
Mm-hmm.
You can go search for them. OpenDNS is very, very popular.
Yeah.
But go check with your ISP. They might have DNS issues. A lot of ISPs have fallback DNSs. You might want to check their secondary DNS, make that one the primary, see if that helps. Those are the best issue or the best solution that I can come up with for this particular problem.
And to expand on this, he did say that he has this with just this one computer.
With the one.
He has a bunch of other machines on the network, and none of these have the same problem. So
it's definitely odd.
Yeah.
You might start checking for spyware.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of spyware will want to, like, poison the DNS, change out your DNS settings.
Yeah.
You might want to check that out.
Okay. All right. From Duncan McGregor, he says, I've just been setting up a new development machine at work, an HP Z420 workstation.
Zed,
of course. I have run a clean install of Windows 8 Enterprise to replace Windows 7 that came pre-installed, and I've set up the BIOS to enable hardware virtualization to run Hyper-V. I've enabled Hyper-V, and I've installed all the applicable drivers from HP for Windows 8. I've installed Office 2010, 2013, Visio 2013, VS 2012, Update 2, SQL Server 2012. This is the second time I've installed Windows 8 on this machine, as I was getting a blue screen first time. I've received a variety of ARC attached outputs from WinBag against the memory dump file. The computer blue screened while I was installing the above software, also while trying to write this email on the affected computer. Any help you can provide would be much appreciated.
I took a look at the dump on this one, and we did have some reports of it internally only,
mm-hmm.
But we were never able to get a repro of it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So that makes these kind of things really hard to debug.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I was looking at was the Hyper-V. Two things that you can try. Make sure that you're running the latest version of the BIOS
mm-hmm.
for this machine. If you are running the latest version of the BIOS, you can go back one, see if that resolves it. The other thing would be just disable Hyper-V for the time being and see if that actually fixes it.
Yeah.
Because from the bug checks that that I looked at, it looked like a particular issue with your processor and timing. And one of the commonalities that I had seen with our internal bug reports was people using Hyper-V with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right, next question. I've run into an issue with the piece of software we're using where users with a single quote in their name is causing the application to crash. I contacted support for the application, and they said the only way to fix this right now is to remove or change the name of the affected users. The software is using SQL and obviously vulnerable to SQL injection. They still neglected my suggestions. It's internal, so I'm not overly concerned, and it isn't housing anything important. Currently, I have two users with a single quote in their name. I need to be able to change their username by removing it, and I also need to change their user profile path on their local machines. How do I go about renaming the user and moving the user's current user profile path to a new one while retaining all the content of it? I know how to rename the user, but I'm uncertain on the correct method of changing the user profile path.
So a couple of things. Make sure that you actually do need to change the profile as it sits on disk. You may actually get away with just changing the username.
Yeah.
If that is still the case, that you do have to change the profile path, you can do that by going into Advanced System Properties, User Profiles, and you can create a new local user profile, mm-hmm. and then copy it. So, you know, there's copy to. You can take an existing user profile and copy it that way.
Okay. Cool.
I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. Some interesting things can happen with copying a user profile.
Yeah.
And usually those ones are hard-coded paths that are stored in the registry.
Yeah.
So just be careful if you have to do that.
Okay, cool. Next question, is it possible to browse external hard drives that have been detached from the system? Let's say I have an external drive, and although I haven't attached it to the system, I could browse which files are available on the drive. Maybe based on the last index. Of course, I could not open any file, but at least one could find out which files are available on a particular drive. I'd like to browse those files with the normal Windows file browser instead of a third-party app. Is there such a tool out there? I think we've talked about this before.
I couldn't find one. There's a capability within the OS for external drives.
Yeah.
The OS does have offline files, but that's for networks.
Yeah.
So if you go to the control panel and you search for Sync Center, you can set up a new sync partnership, and unfortunately they're all for network files.
Yeah.
Now, there are some interesting things that you could do. You could always plug this drive into another machine, share it out, and mm-hmm. boom, instantly becomes a network drive,
yeah.
which would then work in this particular case. The problem with using a sync engine is that it will actually copy your files,
yeah.
right? So yeah. it'll constantly keep them in sync. If that's not what you're looking for, you can always just do a recursive directory listing of the drive.
That'd be my
and then
first
save
pick.
That file, and then, you know, refresh it periodically.
Mm-hmm.
There are third-party tools, I'm sure, that will do something similar that'll be a little bit more graphically aware for you.
But this is all that we have built into Windows.
Yeah, it's really not a common scenario, right, to detach an external drive and still be able to look at the files on it.
Search its contents, yeah. Okay, next question. In Windows 7, you can go to Sound Configuration, select your speakers, and click Configure. You'll then get a dialog called Speaker Setup. You start with a question about audio channels, stereo, quadraphonic, and the next setup, or in the next step, it asks you which of your speakers are full range. What exactly are full range speakers, and how do I know if I have them, and what exactly is the difference between checking and not checking that checkbox? Well, full range speakers means that you have speakers that handle specific ranges, right? So when
you
check that,
the lows, mids, and highs.
Yeah. So the first way to know that is if you have a subwoofer
mm-hmm. built into the speaker.
Yeah, or if you have a big box sitting on your floor that uses a subwoofer, that'd be your first pick, and that means that it's going to send specific ranges of sound to the different devices. So your sub is not going to get the high frequency stuff, it's going to get the bass.
Right.
And your desktop speakers are going to get, you know, the bulk of the rest. So I would say the same thing with setting your speakers as I would with setting your display. Whatever you like is the right setting. So try it both ways, see what you like, and if it works, then just leave it set like that.
Yeah, and if you got your speakers hooked up, you know, through a single audio jack, you know, like a headphone jack or a line-out jack, you're only going to get stereo.
Yeah.
If you're going to get, if your speaker setup is emulating full range, right, it might have some digital signal processor that is faking it for you out of a stereo output. You know, the best sound output that you're going to get is via USB to a 5.1 setup.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of the signal processing is going to be either done with an external DAC or an internal DAC if you got a really good one.
Yeah, that's what I use at home. I have a sound card that I've been using in my main machine at home.
Sound Blaster?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Really.
Really long time.
Yeah, it's been... I looked it up recently. I think it was like 13 years old or something like that. But it still works, and it's got this breakout box that I really love.
Mm-hmm.
So why do anything else?
SB Live, right?
I forget what... It's SB0110, and I know that just because I've downloaded the driver for 13 years now. But yeah, it's a Creative Odyssey 2, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
That is a really, really good one.
Yeah. All right, next question. It wasn't really a question. It's from payapal.com, and it says, Dear PayPal customer, we've faced some problems with your account. Please update the account. If you do not update, you'll be suspended. Of course, it was a spam. I was going through a spam filter looking for questions that end up there sometimes. And it was really clever because all the graphics in the email were pulling from PayPal, but it was just the one link that was going to PayPal. So it was like, it was pretty crafty.
It looked legit.
Yeah, and then we had another one too from Daniel. It says, this message might meet you in the utmost surprise. However, the urgent need for a foreign partner made me contact you for this transaction. I got your contact during my search for a reliable and trustworthy and honest person. I was really impressed they found me. to introduce this transfer, my name's Daniel. I'm the manager of International Commerce Bank of Ghana, and I've got the opportunity to transfer leftover funds of $9.8 million. So I hope it's not premature, but I'm announcing my early retirement. And Gove, I'm going to do a little something special for you when this falls through. All right, which it will fall through. All right, so enough of the spam, pick of the week time. And my pick of the week question this week comes from James. And it's actually a question. He says, hey guys, love the show. I have a question that's not really related to any problems I'm having. Here's my dilemma. I bought a laptop about a year ago, right before the release of Windows 8. The laptop I have is amazing, and I absolutely love it. However, it's not touch-enabled, and right after the Windows 8 release, all those cool-looking touch-screen laptops came out, and I've decided to give my wife the laptop I just bought and buy a new one soon. Why does the wife always get the hand-me-downs?
I know, right? Like, I mean, you know, no offense to the particular person, but if I was in that particular situation, I would keep the laptop and give my wife the nice, pretty touch-screen laptop in order to, you know, score some major points.
Well, good on you. I wouldn't. And my wife gets my hand-me-downs, and she's always complained about that. And I'm like, my hand-me-downs are not that bad. It could be a lot worse. A lot worse. So, all right. So, anyway, going to give the wife the laptop. The problem is, in looking at all the major PC manufacturer websites and reviewing the specs, there doesn't seem to be anything that's terribly impressive. I just keep wondering if there are any that seem to be popular at work, or if you have used any that you would recommend. They're not terribly expensive, under $1,000. Must be touch and must perform. So he wants touch and he wants power. And he wants cheap. So, yeah, under $1,000. So this, by the way, and I got my new Surface Pro, so I'm pretty happy with this. So
this is like a kid in a candy store, man. He's like kind of bouncing up. Bouncing throughout the day here.
Yeah, so I'm going to do a couple things with this, too. I want to show people some cool little hobbies that you can do, like painting on it, because the pen works phenomenally.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best,
what'd I tell you?
The best pen experience ever created for a computer right here. So that I'm really biased towards that. And also,
You have your palm rejection?
Palm rejection works perfect. That's a brilliant idea. I wonder who came up with that.
That Larry has been dogging me for, 6 months?
Yeah.
On touch and palm rejection and hey go, how does the Surface Pro look? How does it look? Is it, you like it?
Yeah.
You know, can't really tell them much, unfortunately, you know,
yeah,
before it was released, but I'm glad that
it's awesome. I love it.
That you agree.
The other thing, I've been using it for like playing guitar. I use it for like show and tab and running my guitar port through it. Mm-hmm. And it's just really cool. I mean, touch is awesome. I'm just thrilled with it. But let's talk about some other machines too. So the first, probably most popular and definitely under $1,000, is the Acer Aspire S7. Nothing wrong with this machine. This is a pretty decent machine, and there's a lot of people here on campus that are using this. So it's pretty nice. So not too shabby, and definitely under $1,000. A couple other honorable mentions would be the Lenovo X1 Carbon. While that one is a little more than the $1,000, this one starts, I think, at $1,400.
Mm-hmm.
This is the machine to have if you're going to be like developing.
And, Road Warrior.
Yeah, so this is a pretty powerful machine. So for the extra $400, you're going to get quite a bit more machine. And so if you're looking for power, you might want to step up to something like this. This would be my other suggestion. And there are tons of these on campus. This seems to be one of the main machines that people refresh to here on campus.
Yeah, and I mean, Lenovo's keys, you'll notice their chiclet keyboard is different.
Island keys.
Island keys?
Yeah, that's what they're called.
But they're so comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, when you're tapping on those, they're definitely very... very comfortable.
Yeah, very nice. Has a little bit of breathing room between the keys, and it does make it nice. And then the other one that I would mention too is one that just came out, or at least it did for us here at Microsoft. It's part of our refresh program. That's a Toshiba KiraBook, and this one is unbelievable looking. I mean, look at that side profile. This is definitely not going to be within the $1,000 range. I think it starts at $1,600.
But it's a competition killer.
It is. It's a nice machine, and if you're ever stuck in the woods, you can chop wood with that shape there. So that's pretty nice. If you want to really step it up, that's a heck of a machine right there. You would not be unhappy with that. But again, I fall back to the Surface Pro because I think it's just one of the finest devices that I've used in quite a while. I'm really happy with it. It's an i5, right?
i5.
So it's not the most powerful machine that I have. And if I go to a conference where I've got to render 100 videos, I'm probably going to take something else with me.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, this is my main machine now.
I really like the i5s because the i5s have virtualization
capabilities,
hardware virtualization capabilities, which I enjoy. But it's also really decent on power. I mean, compared to the i7. An i7 laptop, you know, I consider those to be luggables, you know, mm-hmm. the old style luggables.
Yep.
If you're going to get one, that's a desktop replacement and you're not moving around a lot.
Yeah.
Right? i5s are, I think, the perfect balance.
Yeah.
For power, battery life. You know, on that one, I don't know if you've done it yet, but when I'm on battery, if it's not plugged in, I'll crank down the processor on it.
Yeah.
It'll eke out a lot more battery life. And for the most part, like if you're just doing surfing, if you're just mm-hmm. doing Outlook, perfectly fine. You'll never notice a difference. And you get, you know, an extra hour of battery out of it.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So how big is the difference between i5 and i7? What's the huge performance game? I mean, for gaming, you'd probably want
rendering,
an i7.
Yeah, if you're doing hardcore gaming.
For rendering. You can do it on this. So
Casual gaming, you know, if you're doing... what, Facebook games? If
XCOM Enemy Unknown
works
plays.
Fine.
Yeah, it works fine on it.
All
so.
Of the Windows Store apps will be perfectly fine on an i5.
Yeah.
Be perfectly fine on an i3 for that matter.
Yeah, so if you're looking to save a little bit of money, I would
that
say
too.
An
yeah.
i5 is a good first start.
Mm-hmm.
And plus you'll get the extra battery life from it. So the pain point for me for the Surface Pro has been the smaller disk size. Because I'm used to my big HP laptop that has, you know, a terabyte on board and everything. So to make up for that, I've done two things. I have this on my desk.
Which is heavier than your Surface Pro.
It's bigger and heavier than my Surface Pro. And this is a little hard drive dock, and it lets me use 3.5-inch drives.
Mm-hmm.
It's horizontal, which is a little different from most of the hard drive docks. so you can stack these on top of each other, which is kind of nice.
Comes with a USB 3 hub.
USB 3 hub built into it, so it gets three extra USB ports on the side, which is kind of nice. I wish it was on the back instead of the side, but that's fine. So that was the first thing. And then the second thing is just a little Western Digital mobile drive, which is teeny, 2 terabyte. So that right there, I just throw that in my bag, and it's like, you know, I got more space than I had in my old big laptop, and I'm still small and compartmentalized.
Tiny but mighty.
Yeah, very nice. So, yeah, that would be my suggestions if you're looking to go low dollar.
Oh, but you forgot about the 64 gig flash drive.
Oh, that's the other thing. I stuck a micro SD card in the side of my Surface, so I got another 64 gig. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure when they have 128 gig ones, I'll be, you know,
line
replacing it with that.
Yep.
But 64 gig was a cheap one. I think it was like $30 for.
Yeah,
unbelievable.
The SDXC has, you know, massive room to grow.
Yeah.
I believe it's, what, a 2 terabyte limit on those things, a theoretical limit.
Yeah.
But yeah, we should be seeing 128 and 256s out pretty soon this year, I believe.
Yeah, that would be nice because that'll give me a lot extra hard drive space on the side there. So there you go. That's the show for this week. If you have any questions, you can write us at defragshow@microsoft.com, or you can leave a question in the show notes below the video, and we'll get back to you there. But we like the email, so we can go back and forth with you. And see you next week.
Take care.